This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, it's a real honor for me to have in the studio Jean Matthews, a progressive missionary who spent decades in South Korea working against the dictatorship there. He tells his story in a new book edited by Jim Stencil entitled More Than Witnesses, How a Small Group of Missionaries Aided Korea's Democratic Revolution. Jean Matthews, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Tell me a little bit about your background, where you grew up.
I grew up in rural southeastern Iowa, farm boy from the beginning. Actually, my father moved me out to the farm to save money during the Depression. I grew up rural, went to high school in a little town called Wapello, graduated and worked for a year to get enough money to go to college, and then went to Iowa State College at that time, now Iowa State University.
You don't want to be a farmer?
I did want to be a farmer. I worked on neighbors' farms all my life growing up and thoroughly enjoyed it, thought I wanted to be a farmer, and then got to college and felt a call to go into the mission field.
And who were you a missionary with?
At that time, the Methodist Church. It has since become the United Methodist Church.
And how did you get that call? How does that call arrive?
Well, at that time, the Methodist Church was intentionally recruiting college students to become missionaries, and they created a program called short-term mission service, which meant you go out to a country for 3 years and serve with no commitment to go beyond that time. I applied for that program, was accepted, and they said they wanted to send me to Montevideo, Uruguay, and I said, that's wonderful, I'll go there, I've never been there. When I got to the training session right after college, they said, somebody else wants to go to Uruguay, would you mind going to Korea? And I said, no, that's fine too. So I ended up in Korea.
What year was that?
1956.
And did you know Korean?
I did not know Korea existed until the war had broken out in 1950, and this was 6 years later.
And the language, was it hard to pick up?
Very difficult to pick up, although I didn't know that because I had never studied languages before, so I was foolish enough to not know that it was supposed to be difficult. Linguists say that Korean is the most difficult of the major Asian languages to learn. Hmm. And again, not knowing that, I did quite well in it.
Maybe we all should be so
right.
So ignorant when we arrive. I heard you give a talk last night in which you said missionaries get a bad rap. What did you mean by that?
Well, missionaries are, in many respects, missionaries deal with their history. Missionaries often went into foreign countries on the heels of the colonizing armies. China has a very bad reputation. The missionaries went to China had a very bad reputation for being part of the colonizing forces. And the churches that have emerged from some of those countries have had to struggle for years to overcome the onus of having come out of a kind of a colonizing background. Interestingly enough, that did not happen in Korea because Korea was colonized by Japan. And missionaries went into Korea, in a sense, working for the Korean people against the Japanese colonizers. So they had kind of an advantage at that point. But many, many missionaries are considered to be meddlers, which we are by definition. There are a lot of people in the church now that have a feeling that missionaries should just stay home and not go bother these people overseas anymore.
And just do mission work in the United States?
Right, yeah.
But you don't agree with that?
I don't agree with that.
Why?
I think we have a lot to offer. I think the church is a universal church. I think we have a lot to offer, but we also have a lot to learn. Missionaries who go and spend a whole lifetime in a foreign country, as I did, come back learning a great deal and having a totally different mindset from missionaries that go out and spend a week or 10 days in a work camp in a foreign country. We understand the nuances of the culture. We are able to identify with the people in a way that you cannot do when you go out for a short period of time. I just think there's a genuine value in it. And I at the end of my stay in Korea, I felt I had made a genuine contribution.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. When did you get involved in the democracy movement? How did that start?
Almost accidentally. I was a very naive missionary, as most missionaries are when they first went. And I was initially an agricultural missionary. I went and was helping teach people how to farm. Then I got involved in working with young people and students. and suddenly discovered that some of the people I was working with were being arrested and imprisoned. I even found that pastors of churches that I was working with had been arrested for reasons they could not understand. And I then began to inquire about this and found that there are other missionaries in the country that were having similar concerns. And eventually we united forces and began trying to do something about it.
I'm speaking with Gene Matthews. He spent decades in South Korea with the Methodist Church. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. We're talking about Gene Matthews' book that he had a big part in. The book is called More Than Witnesses, How a Small Group of Missionaries Aided Korea's Democratic Revolution. And I, full disclosure, Gene Matthews is a subscriber of the Progressive, and I visited him when I was in South Korea on assignment many, many years ago. And he opened my eyes to things I hadn't even considered. This getting together of missionaries who were concerned about what was going on in South Korea became known as the Monday Night Group, it says in the book, More Than Witnesses. How did that group get started, and what was the group's function?
The group came together very informally, just a group of us, Catholic and Protestant missionaries, decided one time to get together and pool their information about what was happening. We met in a missionary's home, talked about things, and reported incidences we knew of pastors and students and so forth who had been arrested. And at the end of the meeting, we decided to meet again on another Monday night in a different home. And inevitably, we continued these meetings for almost 3 decades, meeting every Monday night. And that's why we called ourselves the Monday Night Group, because that's when we met.
And Gene Matthews, what were some of the things that you could do to help the democracy movement along?
Initially, we limited our efforts to trying to report overseas what was happening. We would write position papers describing things that were happening in Korea and smuggle them out of the country. Eventually, foreign newspaper reporters began to come and look upon us as a source of information that they could not get anyplace else. Some of them even began attending our meetings. So initially, we saw ourselves as an information-providing group. Later, we began amassing and collecting documents that were not available anyplace else and storing those out of sight and away from the government. And then we sort of branched out, and we began to attend trials of political prisoners. We began visiting people who were in prisons, taking them foods and medicine, books and clothing and so forth. And then we began doing some things that were rather proactive, joining demonstrations on the streets, for example.
Which you don't really associate with missionaries, at least I in my ignorance didn't before. And I think if someone's listening to this in their car or in their kitchen, they're going to wonder why. Why didn't the government crack down on you? How were you able to get away with this?
Well, the government did crack down on us, as a matter of fact. Eventually, two of our members were deported. I was under very strict surveillance by the government. I one time counted 7 different branches of the government that were keeping tabs on me rather closely. An agent of the Korean CIA was assigned to me full-time and monitored everything I did. There were 2 different kinds of police that kept tabs on me, the national police and the local police. The immigration office in Seoul was keeping close watch on me. And then the Ministry of Culture and Information, which was the government ministry that was sort of a catch-all for anything related to religion and culture. And they were keeping tabs on me, too. So we were under very close surveillance.
Did you ever fear for your safety?
Not my safety, no. My Korean friends were under much more danger than I was. The worst thing that could have happened to me probably was that I would have been deported. And I came very close to that on several occasions. At one time, I was picked up by the police and interrogated for a couple of days, and I was certain that that would result in deportation, but it did not. And I was grateful that it did not. I wanted to stay in the country, but that was probably the worst thing that could happen to a missionary in those circumstances.
Mm. You were there under the Park dictatorship and the Chun Doo-hwan's dictatorship. This was in the 60s and 70s.
Right.
And early 80s, I suppose. Tell me what some of the Korean activists were suffering from.
Well, torture was the big thing. The dictatorships, both Park Chung-hee and Chun Doo-hwan, relied very heavily on torture to intimidate the people. There was very little attempt, with the exception of one case, there was very little attempt to extract confessions from people. It was mostly just a way to intimidate people and make them shape up and not get involved. In one case, a number of people, including the husband of one of the writers of our book, was taken in, stripped naked, and beaten severely until he was crawling on the floor, screaming in agony, and then he was released and sent home so he could be sure and tell his friends how dangerous it was to step out of line. That kind of thing happened very routinely.
And this dictatorship was supported by the U.S. government?
Of course, yes, very much so. I think the U.S. government considered South Korea one of its staunchest allies at that time in the struggle against communism, the terrible monolithic evil of communism, which threatened the whole world.
One of the leaders of the democracy movement, Kim Dae-jung, got a Nobel Prize, eventually became president of that country. Tell me about him. What was he like?
He had come out of a part of the country that was in the southwestern part of the country, which was prejudiced against by the rest of the country. In a small country like Korea, which is about the size of Indiana, it's hard to imagine that there are geographical areas of the country where you would face prejudice. But he came from that part of the country, and he was a long-time proponent of democracy. I heard him, the first time I met Kim Dae-jung, he told me that Korea had never had a democracy in all of its history. It went from kings to colonization by Japan to a division, American military government rule, to a war, to dictatorships. And yet he said the Korean people are hungering for democracy. This is a statement that just sort of blew my mind. Because of his longtime stances in favor of democracy, he was targeted by all the governments. He was at one time scheduled for assassination by the Park Chung-hee government. Later, when Chun Doo-hwan was in power, he arrested him and, through a kangaroo court, sentenced him to death. And when we were not certain but what it might be carried out. He eventually survived all that and became probably the first truly democratic president that Korea had when he was elected in 1997.
An impressive person when you met him?
Oh, very impressive, yes.
You talk about one case that's especially moving in this book, and that is when there were eight people arrested on trumped-up charges of belonging to some left-wing communist group that wanted to overthrow the government, and then they were sentenced to execution, and to almost everybody's surprise by your account, they were executed. Mm. Do you want to talk about your involvement in that case?
Well, we had I became aware of them when the Monday night group missionaries attended a Thursday morning prayer service in an ecumenical building in downtown Seoul, which was always surrounded by riot police. And every Thursday morning, we had a prayer service there on behalf of political prisoners. And at one of the services, it was announced that these eight men had been sentenced to death. Now, I had been aware previously that the government had rounded up something like 20 persons and accused them of being part of a group they called the People's Democratic Party, Inhyuk-dong in Korean, and that they had, the CIA had investigated very, very carefully and had concluded that they were plotting to overthrow the government and turn it over to the communists in the north, which was just pure nonsense. The only evidence they ever presented was that one of the men had a shortwave radio that enabled him to pick up a broadcast from North Korea. But there was no other evidence even tying them together. They didn't know each other even. And when they were arrested and sentenced to death, some of their wives began attending the prayer service that we were having. They were not Christians, but they thought the only hope they had was to align themselves with these people. They were very warmly received in the prayer services, and they became a very important part of it. Then when they were sentenced to death, the women went to one of our missionaries, one of our members, who named George Ogle, who, by the way, has studied at Madison at the University of Wisconsin, had roots here, and asked him for help. And so George Ogle did research into the story and decided it was totally untrue. And at the next prayer service, he was invited to pray, and he prayed on behalf of these men. He was then arrested by the KCIA, taken in and held overnight, and ordered never to pray for these men again because it was against the law to do so. Later, he was deported from Korea because of his involvement with the men. After his deportation, we became closely involved in working with the families. We were not allowed to visit these eight men in prison, although we were visiting others, but these men were off limits. When it came time for the Supreme Court to rule on their death sentence, we managed to get into the courthouse at that time. We tell about this in the book, and watched the stern judges come in and in 5 minutes uphold the death sentences on these eight men. And they were carried out the next day, which was against the law because they were not allowed to. The law said that they were supposed to be a three-day delay before they were executed, but they were in fact executed the next day.
And you tell how you had to communicate that the fact that they were killed to one of the men's 12-year-old daughter. That must have just been excruciating.
Yeah, that's still a difficult thing to deal with.
I mean, I'll tell it because it might be hard for you to tell it, because in this book, Gene Matthews, the book is More Than Witnesses, How a Small Group of Missionaries Aided Korea's Democratic Revolution. Gene Matthews was a missionary there for decades, and he had, as he was telling us, he had allied himself and the other missionaries had with the wives of these men who were sentenced to die on trumped-up charges. And the morning that they were executed, one of the daughters, a 12-year-old daughter, called up my guest, Gene Matthews, and asked, "Is it true that my father's been executed?" And Gene said, "Well, I don't think so," because he thought they'd have to wait at least those 3 days that he was talking about. And so he said he'd check, and then he checked, and it was true, and you had to call back that poor 12-year-old girl. I can only imagine that. And then there were protests that day, or the next day, right?
Well, we got word that the men had been... What actually happened was that the morning of the executions, the women were called and told to come to the prisons and meet their husbands, because they had not been allowed to meet them or visit them in prison from the day they were arrested. And so they went with great expectation and hope that they would finally get to see their husbands. What happened was they arrived at prison and were taken in to identify the bodies of their husbands. And when we heard that they were there, a group of us went to the prison to try to see if we could do anything to help. And the two or three of us, Father Jim Sinnott of Mary Knoll Priest and a couple of other missionaries, were able to work our way through the cordon of police around the prison and stand there trying to minister to the women as they came out. That was a very emotional time, too, for us.
Mm-hmm. And at one point in there, we're in the streets and we're interceding between the police or the military and some of the women. And you wrote that you weren't the best pacifist that day.
Right. I found out I'm an intellectual pacifist, but not a very good one emotionally. Two of the men were actually really, all the men were cremated except for two. And we think that they were cremated to hide the marks of torture on their bodies. One was released to their home and was examined by a doctor who did find severe marks of torture. We think the release was probably a mistake. But we got word that another was being released and was heading in a hearse to a Catholic church on the eastern edge of Seoul for a kind of a memorial service. And so Father Sinnott and I and a couple of others got into a taxi heading toward the church. And on the way, we found the hearse had been stopped by the police. And apparently the police were contacted and told the release of this body was a mistake. Please stop the hearse. Well, I'm sure they didn't use the word please, but stop the hearse and bring the body back for cremation. It should have been cremated from the very beginning. So we stopped our taxi and got out, and eventually the riot police arrived in great numbers. We surrounded the hearse trying to protect it. The riot police tore into us and threw us all over the place. And what made me realize I was not a very good pacifist was when one of the big burly riot police grabbed a Canadian missionary woman and threw her to the ground, and I grabbed him and threw him to the ground, realizing later that it was a terribly foolish thing to do. Not only did I violate my pacifist intentions, but it was probably could have been very dangerous, because he was bigger than I am and stronger and well-armed with clubs and rifles and tear gas.
Yeah, that was quite a scene in this book, More Than Witnesses. I'm speaking with Gene Matthews. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. We're going to get to current politics in Korea in a little bit, but the role of women was very important in the democracy movement in Korea. It's discussed in many chapters in this book. Just briefly tell about that.
Korean women are traditionally and by culture are relegated to secondary positions in life. If they're married, they're supposed to stay in the home and take care of the family in the home. They're not supposed to make public scenes. Everything is left up to the men. When the men were arrested, the women emerged from their homes and put up incredibly courageous battles and very clever creative battles against the authorities. They devised ways of marching through the streets discreetly and then suddenly opening up umbrellas, for example, with symbols and signs and anti-government slogans on them. Over the course of time, they became a real threat to the government. And I kind of delighted in this because the KCI agent that was monitoring me, I used to taunt him about his fear of these women because in Korea the women are not supposed to amount to anything. And I think I embarrassed him a great deal by taunting him about the women.
And I know Korea Church Women United, that group had a big role to play.
They did, very much.
And I was fortunate to meet a couple of them when I was over in Korea many years ago when I met you. And something you told me stuck in my mind at the time, which was, I had never thought about it. This was 1987, that you said Korea is going to be united one day. And, you know, I was stuck in my Cold War mentality. This was 2 years before the Berlin Wall came down. And I just thought it was fanciful, frankly, on your part. I didn't know anything about the reunification drive. Why don't you talk about that a little bit and tell us how it got divided in the first place?
Korea was divided without consultation. At the end of World War II, or near the end of World War II, the United States was attempting to bring Russia into the war against Japan, which was unnecessary because the war with Japan was essentially over. But the Americans at that time were weary of war, which was understandable. So they met with the Russians and persuaded them to begin fighting against Japan, which Russia was quite willing to do. They had been victorious in Europe, defeated Hitler, and they thought there was real advantage in fighting against Japan. So they began to make some demands, and one of the demands they made was that they be allowed to come into Korea and accept the surrender of the Japanese in the northern half of the country. And they said the United States can come in and accept the surrender in the southern half of the country, and then we will get rid of the Japanese, send them all home, and then we will pull out, and Korea will be an independent nation again. At that time, nobody knew anything about Korea, and so the people at the present at the consultation sent Dean Rusk, who later became Secretary of State, out of the room to look for a map. He came back with a National Geographic map of Japan, or Korea, and looked at the map and drew a line with his finger across the halfway point and said, this is where we will divide it. I've often thought about what would happen if somebody would divide one of the states in the United States in that way without consulting the people in that state.
It is amazing, the imperial arrogance of that story.
Yeah, and The division has persisted to this day. There are families living on both sides of the line who can't contact each other. They have no connection.
Now, when Kim Dae-jung was president, he instituted the Sunshine Policy, and there were some exchanges. There were some families that could briefly reunite, but that sunshine kind of has set now. The sun has set on the Sunshine Policy because he was replaced by a couple other presidents later on.
Well, his immediate successor tried to continue the Sunshine Policy. Mm-hmm. He was a member of his political party, and a very good man, a very honest man, but not a very powerful politician. Kim Dae-jung, in addition to his abilities, was also a very skillful politician who was able to pull off a lot of things. So during Kim Dae-jung's rule, he was only in office for 5 years, but North and South Korea built a railroad between the two countries. The South established an industrial complex in North Korea and began manufacturing things there using North Korean labor. There were a lot of things that were happening that were very, very exciting. And at that time, quite frankly, we were much closer to unification than even I had imagined when I talked to you that time. There were several things that happened. One was that Kim Dae-jung, when George Bush was elected president, George W. Bush was elected president, it was about 2 years into Kim's term. Kim made a trip to Washington, D.C. to meet the new president. And George Bush used that occasion to lecture Kim about how foolish he was to trust the North Koreans, how ashamed he ought to be to try to work out an agreement with them, in a manner that was very, very insulting to this elderly Korean who had fought all of his life for democracy and was trying his best to work out some kind of a detente with North Korea. Then immediately, Bush also made his infamous Axis of Evil statement and publicly declared that that Kim Jong-il, the president of North Korea, was a moral pygmy, which was a terrible thing to say internationally. In diplomatic context, that was an absolutely insulting thing to do, and really left no out for Kim Jong-il to do anything except react violently. And that's what happened. In Korea, the detente continued in spite of George W. Bush, and relations were going very well until South Korea elected a new president about 3 years ago who liked George Bush, felt in tune with him, and began to push some of the policies that Bush favored.
What hope do you have of what hope is there for reunification? Do you think the next
I'm still hopeful. I think it's going to take some time. It's going to require a lot of patience, and it's going to require a lot more understanding of the Korean mindset than anybody in America has demonstrated recently.
Well, on the flip side, what are the odds, or what are your fears of another war on the peninsula?
Well, I'm desperately hoping it doesn't happen because it will destroy the Korean peninsula if war breaks out again. North Korea, of course, now has nuclear weapons. Whether they will use them or not is a good question. America has demonstrated that they simply do not understand how to deal with the North Koreans.
How should they deal with them?
Well, they need to stop thinking like Americans, for one thing. Americans, for some reason, seem to feel that everybody in the world ought to think like we do. The Koreans are very sensitive about being insulted and losing face, for example. And Koreans are very upset with impatience. Americans want to get things done right away. I think if we had followed Kim Dae-jung's lead and did what Kim Dae-jung was trying to do, we would have had unification within the next 10 years, maybe. It's going to be delayed beyond that now, I'm afraid.
And what do you see with the succession process underway in North Korea with Kim Jong-il and his son?
That's an interesting situation because, in many respects, that suggests that North Korea is not really a communist nation because nepotism is verboten in a communist society. If Kim Jong-il's son actually succeeds him as president, that will be the third generation in the same family that has ruled that country. And because of that, a friend of mine who has been to North Korea several times says North Korea is not a communist society, it's a feudal society. And the king rules and the peasants do what they're told. Whether North Korea will ever reach the point whether they're able to step out of that mold and elect a president of their own genuinely and openly, who knows? I don't know.
Well, I hope that day will come because I know there is that yearning, a very powerful yearning among the Korean people for reunification. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Gene Matthews, thanks for being my guest today.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
It's been an honor to have you on. Gene Matthews has a chapter and some other contributions to this book, More Than Witnesses, How a Small Group of Missionaries Aided Korea's Democratic Revolution. And if you are just coming to this issue of South Korea, and you want to know North Korea too, and you want to know more about it, this is a fascinating way to start to figure out what's going on over there and what's been going on over the last 50 years. The book is More Than Witnesses. Gene Matthews, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.